You are listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. And I'm Thor.
I'm Brian.
And today we are reviewing The Unwritten by Mike Carey and Peter Gross. And this is a story about Tommy Taylor, who's sort of a Harry Potter kind of figure.
Right.
Except for he's real. It's as if Harry Potter's real father wrote about Harry Potter in a fictional sense, but he was a real little boy.
Right.
And grew up.
I mean, so basically if J.K. Rowling had a child named Harry Potter, and she wrote a whole series of books about him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now we are, I don't know, I want to say 20 years past publication of the first book, and Tommy, the real Tom Taylor, as he's trying to convince everybody his
distinguish
name is,
himself from yeah. the character.
He's a, you know, Z-list celebrity who makes his money coming to different comic book appearances, you know, Comic-Con appearances or publishing appearances as signing the books as Tommy Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting story, and seeing as how it comes from, you know, DC Vertigo, you can see very quickly how that's not going to be the real story.
What starts to happen is reality starts to kind of unravel, in that we're starting to see that he may actually be Tommy Taylor, the fictional character, and that this world somehow is magical or has the elements of the fictional world that was written about.
Right. And, you know, it starts out in a very believable way, where he's at this presentation, you know, talking about the Tommy Taylor books, and his father mysteriously disappeared years ago.
Yeah, that's an important detail.
And, you know, so Tom Taylor, you know, as he's, of course, being so grown up, you know, has all sorts of animosity about this, and being a good comic book convention, of course, someone stands up in costume as his arch nemesis, Count Ambrosio, and wants to know, you know, this totally random, obscure plot point about how did Tommy know how to defeat him in this, and, you know, so you see all this. Well, then later on, the real Count Ambrosio shows up to kidnap Tommy Taylor. And so, you know, and Tommy doesn't necessarily believe it. He still thinks it's this guy in costume from the Comic-Con. And so it's introduced in such a way that it's believable and natural, and you can see Tommy's reaction.
It really starts with somebody questioning him about not being his father's real son.
Right.
And so then you start to see the elements of fiction start to blur the line with reality, because people are starting to question whether or not he's even his father's son, and that's really believable. And so it just kind of snowballs from there. And that's what I thought was really well done about this series, is that it takes you from point A, which is our world reality with a Harry Potter-esque type figure. And by the end of the book, he's almost fully immersed into this fictional world,
right,
or we are.
Right.
And it's done in such a subtle and gradual way that I didn't even really notice it until the end. And I was like, kind of like on that fourth issue, when kind of everything just comes to a climax, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, how did I get to this point in this book? I was just sort of engrossed in the writing.
See, and what reminded me as we were going along was Air, and how much I hated the series Air.
Yeah.
Because it failed to establish this sort of alternate reality. And I thought that this book, The Unwritten, did such a good job raising us into it in such a believable manner that you just went along with it.
Yeah. And it does a great job starting out with the actual Tommy Taylor story, the Harry Potter-esque story.
Right.
And it's almost the prose of the story with paragraphs and with the backdrop of what's happening. And it was just such a well-done technique. I really enjoyed that technique. And he sort of establishes this world that's like Harry Potter's, but different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we're introduced to the whole fictional world, is right from the very beginning. And it was done in such a great way that I was almost into just the Tommy Taylor story.
Right.
Let alone, like, what's going on in reality in this book. Right.
And I think that, you know, what I found so enjoyable about this is that this could really be read as kind of a criticism of child celebrity.
Yeah.
And especially when it comes to those kids that are doing the Harry Potter movies. That, you know, one of the big concerns that a lot, you know, you listen to these kids as they've grown up and given interviews, a lot of the concerns that their families have had and that they themselves have had is that, you know, they started this these roles at such young ages and they're going to be playing them for so long. Will they ever be able to break out of being seen as Harry and Hermione and Ron?
Yeah.
And you look at child celebrity, and even, I mean, even adult celebrity, but when you take on such an iconic role, people cease to be able to see you as anything else. I mean, you talk about the Superman curse and, you know, everybody who's played Superman who's just failed to be able to get any other role,
yeah,
you know, after playing Superman. I mean, that kind of thing. But I looked at it, especially with the childhood here and, you know, this Tom Taylor trying so desperately to, you know, on the one hand, be his own person separate from,
yeah,
Tommy Taylor, but at the same time recognizing that he has this direct link. And you know,
it really made him a complex character because he wanted to completely separate himself from Tommy Taylor, but at the same time he's making his living being Tommy Taylor,
right,
at conventions and whatever else. And so if he really wanted that, he could have, you know, gone to school and been a stockbroker or something like, right, that, you know, to completely separate himself from that.
Right, and it's just subtly dropped in there, these little references to it. There's a couple of references to, did I get my fee in this, and what about our fees for this? So it is very, yeah, clear that he's not doing this for the fans. He's not doing, yeah, this because he loves it. He's doing this for the money. And,
yeah,
and yeah, on the one hand, he's, you know, really angry that he's Tommy Taylor, you know, not Tom Taylor, but on the other hand, it's his gravy train.
Yeah.
You know, and he talks about how, you know, that's the other thing, that point about his dad being missing. Because his dad's missing, the entire estate is sort of in limbo.
Yeah.
And so all this money that, you know, everybody assumes should be his, there's no money there.
And the final book wasn't written, right?
Well, as far as we know, but there is the plot.
But it hasn't been released for the public, right?
Well, there was the 14th book was supposed to come out and never came out, and no manuscript was submitted. And then in the middle of this story, in the middle of this collection, a manuscript is delivered,
yeah,
to the former editor of the Tommy Taylor book, saying, here's the 14th, enjoy.
But what makes it a bigger deal, I guess, is what I'm getting at, is that it's as if J.K. Rowling would have left after book 6 and mysteriously just sort of disappeared for 20 years.
Right.
And the series wasn't completed. And so there's sort of this ravenous following for it because it wasn't completed.
Right. And so, yeah, exactly. That there is, I think that this, as much as the authors say that, yes, there is, you know, some reference to Harry Potter and they had it in mind, but there's all this other stuff. I think that there's no way to read this without seeing that direct connection to Harry Potter on so many levels. And that's what makes it even more believable, if,
yeah,
you will, is that because we have something so analogous in our lives, in our world, we can immediately create that direct connection to it. It's not like something where we have to wrap our brains around something being so popular that,
yeah,
you know, 20 years later, people are still clamoring for it. No, we have that in our lives.
Yeah.
And so
there's a lot of really complex issues brought up as well, like with the creative process, in that there's a writer's retreat, and just about like the creative process and how it's these professional writers really trying to hone their craft, if you want to say that, but clashing at the same time.
It was interesting that it's not only professional writers. Tommy Taylor goes to a home that
it was where Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein,
and apparently Milton came up with the idea for Paradise Lost, and where his dad wrote several of the books. And I was a little unclear, maybe it was just my reading, I was a little unclear if he actually still owned the estate of his father, still owned the house. That was unclear.
I thought that it was never owned, and maybe he had leased it or rented it for a series of time, and so it wasn't his house. That's my impression, but...
Yeah, but there's definitely, Tommy Taylor feels like, you know, he has a strong connection to this house.
Yeah, he spent a number of years
there with his dad. But yeah, there's this interesting connection that, you know, you have such iconic, almost horror images. You have the Frankenstein monster, you have Milton, and as Tom Taylor points out, that, you know, basically this version of hell was created there. I mean, so much of what we consider to be our concept of hell actually comes from Milton's Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. And then what's interesting, though, is that this collection of writers who are at this retreat are all modern horror writers. And it just doesn't hold up. I mean, their version, they all go through and say, I'm so-and-so, and I write under this name, and this is what
And it really breaks down a lot of the horror genres, and they're immediately recognized.
Yeah, it breaks down the horror genres, but you look at it and go, this is just schlock.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, for a house that created Frankenstein and Milton, and even, I mean, if you want to go with Tommy Taylor / Harry Potter, you know, these complex stories and characters, that there's just this just crap that, you know, everyone's there to kind of soak in the ambiance of it all and get inspired by it.
Yeah. And while I really enjoyed the first four issues and was totally engrossed in the story, what really cemented this book for me was the fifth issue, where it breaks away from everything, even modern day, and really goes into Rudyard Kipling's life and kind of merges it with this fictional reality that he's set up, that Mike Carey's set up in the modern day, and really just kind of weaves this background tapestry in with Rudyard Kipling's, like, real life.
Right.
And that, to me, just blew me away. That was so well done, and I don't know, I just enjoyed that so much, and it really enriched the whole world that he's built up.
Well, and that's the thing, is that, you know, there's this, I won't call it a subplot because it's too major for a subplot, but maybe a parallel plot going on in this story that, in addition to Tommy Taylor's world completely unraveling around him, there is this sort of background organization, if you will, that has a tie to Tommy Taylor's father.
Yeah.
And so tangentially has a tie to Tommy Taylor. And that's kind of what you're getting at with the Rudyard Kipling, is that they have managed to control literature throughout the ages so that their points of view, their idea of what should be shown, is what gets published.
Yeah,
and
whoever doesn't conform to this cabal, they sort of
mysterious things happen.
Yeah, which is, and he brings up several writers, like Oscar Wilde was one, and the real events in that person's life he sort of explains in this whole tapestry that he's weaving, and that to me was just fascinating.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a fictional conspiracy theory.
Yeah, it's very speculative history.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can look at it and it weaves together so well. And again, it brings us back to this, because all these things happen. I mean, you take out this mysterious cabal of people that are, you know, controlling the world, if you will. But all of those things in history really happened.
Yeah.
And if you string it together and say, okay, well, it was done because of this, Well, again, then it brings us back to this idea of the Tommy Taylor story, and why couldn't there be, you know, this group of people that's controlling, mm-hmm. you know, all of the publication of his story. And then, of course, want to control that.
Yeah. And so that, for me, is what turned this book from a good book, mm-hmm. and enjoyable book, to really a great book that I am clamoring for, like, the next trade, and can't wait to see where this series is going.
You know, there are some real interesting pieces to this book. And like I said, I think this book, this first section, asks a lot of questions and answers very few, if any, which mm-hmm. That's why I'm a little surprised how excited you are for the next one, because I know how you like to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this story has no beginning. Well, it has a beginning, has no middle, no end.
Yeah.
And this is definitely one chapter in a much larger story. This is not a...
It's true.
...discrete piece of writing. The other thing that makes it difficult for me is the... sort of the enforcer of this cabal is a guy named Pullman, who has a wooden hand, and with this wooden hand basically can create and destroy whatever he wants. And it's a neat trick, it's a neat visual, that when he destroys it, it sort of becomes...
Liquefies.
Yeah, liquefies, but the words of what that object was is left, or the letters are left floating yeah. in the pool. And it's just kind of a neat trick, but we get so little information about Pullman. We don't understand, sort of, because he seems to have a very personal grudge against Tommy Taylor and Tommy Taylor's dad.
Yeah.
That we don't quite understand why he is so intent on, you know, ruining his life. You know,
because it goes beyond just that he was ordered. It's right. Really seems as though it's a personal vendetta.
Right. And
beyond his orders that he was given to do it.
Right. And there's some, you know, sort of a bleak reference to the fact that he may actually be the devil. And which, you know, since he comes and, you know, raises hell at the writer's retreat, and you look at, you know, the Frankenstein monster, and then again, like I said, at Milton's creation of, you know, our concept of hell, there's sort of an interesting idea that maybe this is the devil, you know, incarnate. But that would be really hard for me to see how then he would be under the control of this
group of a human.
Yeah, because it's very clear that Pullman is being reined in by...
Yeah, exactly.
Somebody on the other end of this phone, that there is somebody else that's pulling his strings and very clearly shaping and molding him in the direction they want him to go. So I kind of want to know more about him, to know why he hates the Taylors so much, but also how he got into this situation where he is so directly under their control.
Yeah.
And again, none of this was answered. No, I mean, we there's nothing there. And so for me, you know, I'm with you. I want to know what happens next, but I need just a little bit more here to...
I can see where you're coming mm-hmm. from, but for me, I guess I was so impressed with how much we got and how much this world was completely mm-hmm. fleshed out and really came alive in my mind when I was mm-hmm. reading this, that I'm willing to overlook little things like that, because I feel like he accomplished a great deal in these first five issues.
Really, even four issues.
Yeah.
Because the fifth issue, I mean, the fifth issue does not progress the story.
Yeah.
The fifth issue fills in a lot of very important background information, but without progressing the story.
Yeah. And so I am so impressed with what he has done in these first four issues that I'm willing to overlook like little things like that, because I have confidence that those things are going to be answered later mm-hmm. because he has taken such care and added so much detail to this world that I almost feel like there's no way that he could not address those details later on.
See, I feel like this is a very solid book. I mean, I don't want to go and heap a ton of praise on it and make it, you know, all glittery and sparkly and say this is absolutely, you know, amazing, fantastic, reach out and grab it. This is solid storytelling at its basic. I mean, it is, you know, main character who we can see as a complex character in a believable world, regardless of how fantastic it is.
Yeah.
I mean, a believable world. I mean, suspension of disbelief, completely on board here.
Yeah.
A discernible plot, you know, a mysterious antagonist that I would like fleshed out a little bit more, but I agree with you. It's coming.
Yeah.
I mean, that clearly there is a map to this. And, you know, and a pacing that works.
Yeah.
This didn't feel rushed. This didn't feel stretched out. I was actually kind of surprised that it was only 4 issues of storytelling, and then they went to a 5th issue of background. We don't get that anymore. I mean, it's the first 6 issues to get people to walk through a door, basically. So I really feel like this is on the level of Fables. This is on the level of Why the Last Man, where this is a very solid foundation, just quality storytelling, art which worked so well with the storytelling.
It wasn't really standout art, but it really worked well with the story, and I never felt myself being pulled out by the art in any way, either in a fantastical way or in a shoddy way.
Right, well, and it has to be a level of believability in the art, because the fantastic is more about the situation than the people.
Yeah.
The fantastic is more about, you know, things are not quite how you believe them to be. And so when you get these fantastic elements, like this great scene where he's visiting his father's mistress, and she lives in this little apartment in, where is it, Paris, I think. And she just says, go count the stairs. And he looks at her like, what are you talking about? She says, just things are not as they seem. Go count the stairs. And he goes in this, you know, basically in this hallway to count the stairs. And it just keeps going and going and going and going. And that was such a great, fantastic, eye-catching scene because everything else had been so well executed and so believable that when you get the fantastic, it really pops.
And I really enjoyed the art on the 5th story because it takes a definite turn.
Right.
You can see between the 2 pages of the 5th issue and the 4th issue a distinct difference that's really like the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And it immediately takes you back into that time. And I think that he really capitalizes on Kevin O'Neill's style there just to draw you immediately into that time period.
And the coloring is completely different.
Yeah.
All different color palette. Very yellow, very brown. Which, again, gives us a feeling of time past.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it was a great job. And it really sticks out because, like you said, it gives us a feeling that this is separate yet somehow attached.
Yeah.
Because the art is not so completely different and so jarring. It doesn't feel like something that's being shoehorned in there.
Yeah, exactly.
To fill in a gap.
Makes sense.
Right. And so it's nice to have something that makes sense and feels like it's there for a purpose in comics. Because sometimes I feel like, you know, oh, we've got to throw this in. Speaking of just coloring and art, you know, hats off to Vertigo. This is, again, their $9.99 first trade promotion. They have switched their paper quality. You and I have talked about it several times with their other, you know, initial offerings for a series that is $9.99, but the paper quality is not, you know, this high-grade glossy paper that we see in, you know, so many other books.
Yeah.
And while it hasn't necessarily detracted from a story, because the writing is so solid, there's a real difference, and it really makes the art just pop in this, having the high quality printing.
Yeah.
So you're back for more, despite the fact that there was no end in this one.
Definitely.
You know, I've been hearing stuff that, you know, kind of grumblings that Mike Carey is starting to ask fans sort of what stories they want or what characters they want him to interact with, which I think is kind of interesting because there's a lot of the other sort of subplot point in this is that the only thing that Tommy Taylor has from his father is an encyclopedic knowledge of locations.
Yeah, in literature. Story,
literary locations. And not just where they would be on a map, but like talking about Orwell's 1984 and how this particular building was the model for the Ministry of Truth. Now, it's not, I mean, clearly not the Ministry of Truth, but
yeah,
you know, this particular building. So it's interesting that Carey is asking for input for stories because, you know, it'll be looking at, you know, stories around the world and then, I guess, you know, where that would be. But I think it's kind of interesting that he's taking that kind of fan input.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me, it does give me that little bit of a hitch of, okay, this is, I want this to be planned out. I want him to have a real roadmap for it. But if he's asking for this kind of fan input, doesn't that make the future very, I don't know, you know.
I don't know, because there. I could, I mean, for me, it seems like a plot is like a skeleton framework with uh-huh. points that you have to get to throughout. And maybe he's asking for input on how people think that he should flesh that out. And so, I mean, I'm just assuming that he knows where things have got to go. And maybe he's just asking for more input into how to get there.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's one of those things where I...
It's unique.
It's very unique. I don't know, maybe I'm scared of things that are different. But, you know, I want the writer to be in control.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily want the fans to be in control. And that sounds crazy because, you know, I get very upset with, you know, like Marvel, which, you know, I've been reading Marvel for 25 years and I don't like the direction that several of the characters that I've grown up with have taken.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the part of me that as a fan is like, how dare you do this to my character? But then I look at some of those classic stories over the years and they never would have happened if the fans would have said, oh, please, you know, leave him alone. But in a story like this, where it's not so much a character that we're following throughout time, but really we're looking at an arc and we're looking at a complete story, I want the writer to be in full control of this. And I think that's what has, you know, a couple of people nervous, has me a little nervous about it, is because, you know,
yeah,
how much control does he have over this whole story arc if he's looking for input? I would kind of want to know why he wants it. Is it just, hey, I'm looking for a couple of locations because, you know, we're gonna have all these characters show up and, you know, I want to know who you want to see, that kind of thing? Or is it, oh, you know, I'm on issue 45 and I don't really have anywhere to go, and, you know, Tommy Taylor's on walkabout, and I figured, hey, you know, why don't we have him show up at, you know, Chuck Palahniuk's house? I mean, why not? That I wouldn't mind seeing. That would be fun. But yeah, so
there you go. There's your input.
There you go. Mike Carey, you wanted to know. I want Tommy Taylor and Chuck Palahniuk to sit down and have a conversation. But yeah, so I'll be interested to see where this goes. This definitely is on my immediate pickup list. You know, at the end of last year, we talked about how a lot of our favorites for the year were wrapping up this year or wrapped up last year. We lost Young Liars. The last trade just came out.
Mm-hmm.
The final Scott Pilgrim's coming out this mm-hmm. year. You know, there's just a lot of series. Oh, we're going to lose Ex Machina. We're going to lose Fear Agent this year. There's a lot of, you know, series that you and I have been kind of invested in over the years. I think I found one to make up for some of the things we're losing. The Unwritten is on my pull list from here on out.
Yeah, I agree.
That this is one that I'm on board to see where this goes for quite a while.
I agree.
Especially if I know that this is going to have an end. I think that what is dragging me down about books like The Walking Dead, which I enjoyed for quite a while, is that now I just feel like it's just kind of plodding along, and I don't feel, I feel like it needs an end. You know, there needs to be an end point somewhere. And I feel like, you know, Tommy Taylor has to have an arc here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm willing to hold on for a few years. I mean, Why the Last Man is I think, should be held up as the banner for how you end a series.
Definitely.
And I think that you can tell a long-form story and have people along for 5-6 years, as long as there's an end in sight. And I think that if, you know, I know that Mike Carey has in his vault at home, you know, the final chapter written the way that J.K. Rowling had the final chapter of Harry Potter written for years and years and years, you know, then I think this is going to be a fantastic ride.
Yeah, I agree. I'm excited for the future of this book.
So definitely go pick it up. You know, like I said, the $9.99 price point, way to go, Vertigo. And you know, especially now with the higher quality printing, that's just fantastic.
Yeah, they've got me on board. Yeah. So,
and we have a free preview of The Unwritten on our website. You can check us out at stumptowntradereview.com. There's a link to the free preview of the first chapter of Unwritten there. You can follow us on Facebook, and we'd love to hear from you.
You got it!